From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to the March 2020 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, Plunder on the Rhine. As 1945 began, the Germans' last roll of the dice in the Ardennes had failed. They were left to face the overwhelming force of men and material of the Allied armies approaching the fatherland from all directions. For the Allies in the West, the natural barrier of the Rhine River was all that lay between them and the open plains of Germany and the last phase of the war in the West. Meanwhile, the government code and cipher school at Bletchley Park were producing more intelligence than ever before. But for how much longer? We'll find out how it was at this point that the Germans challenged the Codebreakers like never before. In this It Happened Here episode, our research officer, Dr. Thomas Cheetham, will take us through the action on the front line and reveal just how difficult it was becoming to keep supplying actionable intelligence in the last year of the war. As usual, special thanks go to Mr. Ben Thompson for voicing our archival documents.
This is Bletchley Park. It happened here.
With Allied armies moving in on Germany from east and west, the German High Command finds itself, to put it mildly, in an unenviable position. To tell you something about it, here is Columbia's military analyst, Major George Fielding Elliott.
From the point of view of the German High Command, the war situation must look something like this. On the east, the two heavily fortified flanking positions on which the defense of the Reich initially depended, East Prussia and Upper Silesia, have been overrun. This releases, for further attack westward, the best part of two Russian army groups. What is needed is more troops for the defense of the open frontiers of the Reich and the approaches to the Reich capital from the east. On the west, the time-gaining counterattack in the Ardennes failed with heavy losses. The V weapons have damaged the Anglo-American allies but have not prevented the gathering of powerful forces and vast amounts of supplies through the port of Antwerp. Now the Western Allies, having pushed up to the Ruhr River all along its course, are getting ready to jump off into the Rhineland with a major offensive. Sooner or later, the German High Command may find themselves confronted with the grim choice of which of their frontiers shall be defended at the expense of the other. Too many Germans have been killed for both to be defended indefinitely. For this reason, perished the Empire of Napoleon. And for this reason, more than a century later, the empire of Adolf Hitler is going down in blood and fire.
In our last podcast episode, we looked at the Ardennes offensive and the critical impact on the German forces in Europe, sort of December 44, January 1945. Thomas, can you tell us what the situation is in Northwest Europe in January and February 1945?
Well, so obviously what happens next sort of leads on from the Ardennes. That's really the last roll of the dice for the Germans, in the West at least. Very quickly after they launch their counteroffensive, it's clear that it's not going to reach its objectives, but they push on with it regardless. By the start of January, the momentum has run out and the Germans are retreating, but the fighting goes on for the sort of bulge that's been created in the Allied line all the way up till the end of January. And there's a couple of occasions where the Germans try to rekindle the momentum. They launch another offensive against Patton's Third Army further south at the Ardennes, which is called Operation Nordwind. And that's their last major offensive in the West, actually. The idea is to take pressure off the Ardennes so that forces in the Ardennes can then keep attacking. It doesn't work. It just leads to more German troops being sort of pinned down and destroyed, and they're the troops that the Germans can not really afford to replace at this stage. As part of that, on the 1st of January, the Luftwaffe launch a big offensive of their own, which is called Operation Bodenplatte. The idea is to hit Allied airfields across that part of the front, hit Allied aircraft on the ground, strike a strong blow against them and try and compete for air superiority. There are a lot of Allied planes destroyed, about 400, but the Germans lose about 200 planes of their own. And the important thing is that they also lose pilots and they can't replace the pilots. So after losing that many planes and pilots, the Luftwaffe really is a spent force as well. So really, by the end of January, we're looking at the beginning of the end. There's not really any conceivable way that Germans can come back from this situation. Really, by counter-attacking, they've just made things worse and they've hemorrhaged forces and put themselves in a weaker position. So it's going to be even harder for them to hang on.
It feels like the Germans are very much in retreat and facing defeat in the West. Was it the same on the Eastern Front?
Yes, the situation is sort of equally dire on the Eastern Front. Obviously, the Germans are trying to balance their forces and, hold off all their enemies, but that's becoming increasingly impossible. And the Soviets have been sort of poised in the East all winter, basically preparing for, their next big offensive, which is going to fall sooner or later. We talked in a previous episode about how they had been approaching Warsaw, but they hadn't captured the city because they basically left the Poles to fend for themselves. The Polish Home Army had risen up in Warsaw against the Germans in the expectation that the Russians were going to liberate the city. And the Russians had paused their offensive and the Germans had been able to crush that uprising. So the effect that the Ardennes counteroffensive has on the East is that it causes the Russians to bring their offensive forwards, and they launch it on the 12th of January ahead of schedule by about 2 weeks because the Germans have thrown all their armoured reserves into the Ardennes. So they finally occupy Warsaw on the 17th of January, and basically by the end of March they've liberated most of modern-day Poland. Liberated, probably not exactly the right term. They'd captured most of modern-day Poland. What this creates is a pocket around East Prussia. Germany at the time was split. This was one of the causes of the war, was that Germany was split between, the main part of Germany and East Prussia, which was cut off by the Danzig Corridor. And this is one of the reasons why the Germans wanted to invade Poland in the very beginning. The Germans fall back. They're trying to protect what is ethnic German territory more than Polish territory. So this forms a pocket around East Prussia. And as this gets smaller and smaller, the Germans carry out a very large scale operation to evacuate refugees and troops. And this leads to great loss of life in the Baltic. There are ships leaving the ports, which are torpedoed and sink, and many, many people are killed. So things are not going well for the Germans in the East whatsoever. It's all falling apart there equally as it is in the West. As part of this offensive, the Russians also start to discover concentration camps for the first time, most famously Auschwitz, which is liberated on the 27th of January. That's the reason we now commemorate Holocaust Memorial Day on that date. This whole question of what Bletchley knew and what the Allies' response to the Holocaust was is something we're going to come back to in a later episode in a lot more detail and do proper justice to. Another important point about the East is that the Allies don't find out about the Russian offensive for a few days. And when they do find out, it's from Ultra. So even before the end of the war, one of Bletchley's jobs is becoming monitoring what the Russians are doing by looking at German communications, because the people who are closest to the Russians and are reporting on what they're doing are the Germans. So that's quite an interesting twist on what we normally assume is happening here. Basically, by the end of March, start of April, the Russians are on the Oder River. So next will be an attack on Berlin itself. We should also mention, if we're talking about February, that there's been a meeting, a conference between Churchill, Roosevelt and Stalin in Yalta in the Caucasus.
Why was it in the Caucasus?
Mainly because Stalin didn't like to fly. He didn't want to leave the country. So Churchill and Roosevelt had to go to him. Also, it's liberated territory. So Yalta's where a lot of the decisions are made as to how Germany and Japan are going to be dealt with at the end of the war, and especially how they're going to be divided between the Allies, about spheres of influence and so on. And this is something that's going to come back and prove to be very important in a later episode when we look at the final defeat of Germany.
So just to get the fuller picture, what about other theatres of war at the start of 1945? What about the Pacific?
The war in the Pacific goes on. The British are on the offensive in Burma. We talked in a previous episode about turning back the Japanese at Imphal and Kohima, and now they're pushing into Burma throughout sort of early 1945. The Americans are also carrying on a sort of two-pronged attack. They've got their island-hopping campaign, which by now has made it to Iwo Jima. So they're fighting for this kind of small volcanic island, which has an airfield on it, which is needed if they're going to bomb Japan. And the other prong is that they're fighting in the Philippines. General MacArthur, when US forces were pushed out of the Philippines in 1942, made the promise that he would return, and he's true to his word. So from sort of the start of February to start of March, the Americans are fighting over the Philippines capital, Manila, and that's ongoing.
In the Pacific, on Iwo Jima, the Marines are slowly pushing their way through the last Jap defenses. The pressure is telling on the bitterly fighting enemy, who is trying to make our conquest as costly as he possibly can. The 3rd Marine Division patrol, which fought its way onto Iwo's northeastern beach yesterday, reported back to Major General Erskine that they had washed the Japanese stench from their hands in a piercing move that cut the Jap defenders in half. Other spearheads were driven to the Jap-held end of the island, breaking the enemy remnants into ever smaller pockets of resistance. Garrison troops on Iwo are going to have little spare time on their hands. They'll be busy for months hunting down Japs who choose to hide in caves rather than fight it out in the open and be killed. Allied forces in Burma have been stepping up their campaign recently. And for a summary of the battle situation on the Burma front, here is Columbia's military analyst, Major George Fielding Elliott.
The tremendous military events in Europe and the dramatic storming of Iwo Island have almost caused us to lose sight of the operations in Southeast Asia, where Allied arms are registering remarkable gains. In Burma, British and Indian troops are fighting in the capital city, Mandalay. Half the city is already in Allied hands. The Japanese are still holding Fort Dufferin, an old fort within the city limits, but this looks very much like another one of those stupid suicide stunts, such as the Japanese Marines pulled off in Manila. It makes no military sense. It just saves what the Japanese call face. Finally, northeast of Mandalay, another success is chalked up for the British, American, and Chinese troops of the Northern Combat Command. These troops have taken the railhead town of Lashio, terminus of the old Burma Road. And so, in all the Burmese theater, the word is victory.
The focus of this episode is the Rhine. Can you bring us back to the Rhine and what was happening there?
Right, so if we look at what's happening sort of in early February 1945, for me, actually, this is something that I think is not often talked about as much as it should. The Allies aren't at the Rhine yet. They've reached the Rhine actually in Holland, the lower Rhine, but the actual part of the Rhine that they want to cross in Germany, they haven't reached yet. So before they get to crossing the Rhine, they've got to get to the river itself. And the way they plan to do this is through an operation called Veritable. The British use this salient that they've created in Holland back in September in Market Garden around Nijmegen. And they actually turn it sort of 90 degrees to the lower Rhine. And the idea is that they'll drive down the Rhine going east and clear the Rhineland, that area just to the west of the Rhine. And at the same time, in a sort of pincer movement, the US 9th Army will launch an operation called Grenade, moving up sort of from the south. So the British and Canadians are moving parallel to the Rhine, the Americans are moving sort of perpendicular to the Rhine, and they'll meet eventually.
Were these two operations running side by side, or was there somebody in overall charge of both of these coordinated?
Well, the reason they're coordinated is because the US 9th Army is actually under the 21st Army Group, which is Montgomery's command. During the Battle of the Bulge, because of the sort of communication situation, he took command of that US Army and he's held onto them. So he's able to coordinate these two operations. And the idea is that the British will attack and the US will follow up pretty quickly. But as it turns out, the American element of the operation is held up for quite a long time, about 20 days. It's delayed because as soon as the British launch their offensive, which is on the 8th of February, the Germans release water from the Ruhr dams, not to be confused with the Ruhr. The Ruhr River is an obstacle that the Americans have got to cross to reach the Rhine, and they've been fighting in the Hürtgen Forest, as we talked about before, back in October, November, to try and capture some of these dams, because they were worried that the Germans were going to flood them. They didn't capture the dams. The Germans did indeed release all that water downstream, and the Americans literally have to sit and wait until it recedes.
So this big coordinated operation becomes less coordinated as the Americans have this delay.
Yeah, to an extent, but also it sort of plays into the Allies' hands, because as the British and Canadians advance, they draw in the German reserves. And when the Americans advance, they actually have quite an easy ride of it, in as much as any operation can be easy. I think if we look at the way in which the Allies are really smashing their way through the German lines, and they have overwhelming preponderance of pretty much everything. Air support, artillery, tanks, and troops on the ground as well. The British are quite low on infantry most of the time, and the Americans are in certain cases, but they still outnumber the Germans. One of the real benefits for the Allies is in their armour support, because at this stage we're seeing German divisions get down to a handful of tanks, 10 or 4 or something, in an entire division. Whereas the Allied tankers, if they get their tank knocked out or they break a track or it gets bogged down or something, they quite often just hop out, go to the rear area and they're given a new tank. And they're back in the front line in a few hours and able to get on with things. That's something that is completely beyond the ability of the Germans. It's probably beyond the ability of any army up to that point. So that's a really nice example of just the preponderance of strength that the Allies have at this stage. One of the interesting innovations in this battle is that the Allies are starting to use what we would now call armoured personnel carriers. They have kind of two types. They've got Kangaroos, which are self-propelled guns with the gun removed, and that gives you a nice big armoured box, which you can fit probably 10 or 12 men in. And the other thing which is especially useful when you're looking at flooded terrain is Buffaloes, which are these amphibious troop carriers with a ramp on the back, like a sort of landing craft with tracks. Even though a lot of the armour gets bogged down, it's not very effective, and the infantry have to rely on their artillery support to make progress. They do have these armoured vehicles which they can use to cross ground in relative safety. And that is actually quite a big innovation. And it's something that in modern armies you see across the board. But in the Second World War, it was actually a very new idea of putting infantry in armoured vehicles to transport them around.
And now, a news report radio direct from Supreme Headquarters in France. Charles Collingwood reporting.
On the waterlogged Western Front, the 1st Canadian Army continues to be the center of interest. This army, which includes English, Scotch, and Welsh troops, as well as Canadians, is pushing its way through the Siegfried Line southeast of Cleves. Yesterday, they made a mile or so and took several hundred prisoners. The Canadian Army is now only a mile and a half from the town of Gawk, which today's communique, in a rare turn of phrase, calls a bastion town in the Siegfried defense belt. The fighting up here in the mud and among the German defenses is as unpleasant as it comes. An officer of the Scots Fusiliers came down to Paris today to talk about the capture of Cleves. He had red hair, a red mustache, and a Scotch accent you could cut with a knife. He told of how the carriers kept getting stuck in the mud. But when they did, he said, we just pulled the blokes off that and piled them on another, and on they went. Off on his left, he could see the Canadians paddling around in the water. His own men were on high ground and went in supported by what he called the funny people, the men who drive the flamethrowers and the special tanks and all the strange instruments of war the Canadian Army is using. But the Germans find nothing funny in the way they fight. This is Charles Collingwood in Paris, returning you to New York.
What was the outcome of Operation Veritable for both sides involved?
Basically, by about the 10th of March, the Allies are on the west bank of the Rhine. So they've achieved their objectives. Because the American advance is delayed, the British and Canadians are facing more German forces than they expected. And this leads to a bit of a pause while they regroup and reorganise to continue the push. So they resume their advance in an operation called Blockbuster on the 22nd of March. And by that point, the Americans are advancing because the waters have receded sufficiently. On the 3rd of March, the two sides link up. And as I say, by the 10th of March, they are on the west bank of the Rhine. Further south, to the flank of 9th Army, the US 1st Army is then able to start its own advance in an operation called Lumberjack. The reason it's a problem if we overlook Veritable and Grenade is because this is the big battle that really destroys the German army. It's a hard-fought battle. There's heavy casualties on both sides, about 23,000 Allied casualties. But all in for the Germans, they lose about 90,000 men, about half of those taken prisoner, the rest killed and wounded. That means that when the Allies do come to cross the Rhine, they have a much easier job. And really a sensible opposition would have retreated behind the big natural defensive line and made the best use of it. And this is what the Allies are really afraid of, that they're going to have to launch an assault river crossing over this enormous river into the teeth of well-manned defences. But in the end, there isn't a lot of opposition because all those troops that should have been defending the Rhine have all been killed or captured the other side of the Rhine. So the logic of defending the Rhineland is very questionable, I think.
CX-MSS-T458-10. Gauleiters were notified on the 9th of March 1945 by Reichsleiter Bormann concerning measures to meet Allied offensive in the West. A. All party functionaries and office holders, as well as state officials, must remain at posts in all circumstances. B. Importance of accurate reports is stressed. C. A decree concerning setting up of drumhead court martials would give Gauleiters, as commissioners for defence of the Reich in threatened areas, responsible for maintaining war morale, a weapon with which to annihilate all persons dangerous to the state. This instrument to be used ruthlessly. Previous meritorious service, even in cause of the party, not to protect leaders who failed culpably in directly threatened areas. D. Allied offensive in the West not to be followed by new large-scale evacuation, which, within Reich, would meet stream of fugitives from the East and deprive Germans of any military or civilian freedom of movement. Even removal of women and children could become a signal for mass flight, and would therefore, as a rule, be limited to local movement. E. Elements of population remaining behind, therefore in future no longer to be regarded as traitors. Nevertheless, measures must ensure removal of those whose capacity to work could aid allies. Measures for removing specialists and men capable of bearing arms to be re-examined. F. Positions and fortifications built in course of national call-out were useless, as shown by experience in the East, unless continuously manned. G. Development of fortresses and local strong points to be pushed on with all means and speed. Party officials in charge of fortresses to keep Gauleiters informed on progress of early stocking up of fortresses. H. Rounding up parties to be employed promptly to curb any tendency to softness on part of frontline troops. These parties to be supported in case of need with all means, police and Volkssturm.
The Allies are poised on the west bank of the Rhine on the 10th of March. On the 11th of March, what happens next?
Well, it'll be a little bit of time before they launch their assault crossing. It's been something that's been in the planning actually for a few weeks, but it'll take time for them to get ready for that operation. There's a lot of logistics to organise. But actually, by the 10th, they've already got a crossing over the Rhine. They haven't had to launch an assault crossing in the end because they've captured a bridge. And this is what might be mildly termed a cock-up from the Germans. And it's one of the most famous incidents of the war. It's the bridge at Remagen. And this is one of the last surviving bridges over the Rhine. Most of them have been demolished by this stage. And US forces of 9th Armoured Division advancing in Operation Lumberjack happen across this intact bridge. It's very badly defended. And they're given this opportunity because the Germans have, through their sort of top-down control, have hindered themselves once more. Because the Mulheim Bridge in Cologne, a few weeks before, was destroyed accidentally. It was rigged to blow with all its demolition charges on it, and an airstrike set off the charges and demolished the bridge ahead of time. This made Hitler very angry, and he decreed that no bridge is going to be wired for demolition before the Allies are within 5 miles of it, 8 kilometres, and no bridge is to be demolished unless an explicit written order is handed down to the person on the scene, and then that order is only to be carried out at the very last moment as the Allies approach the bridge. At Remagen, this all comes back to bite the Germans, because the US troops see this intact bridge and they start to cross. And the Germans have only been able to, at the very last minute, set explosives on the bridge, but they don't have enough explosives, first of all, and they are of the wrong type. They're of a sort of weak industrial type of explosive that really isn't up to the task of knocking down this enormous railway bridge. And then there's further delay while they have to wait for that written order. What's handy is that the Germans actually, because their communications have broken down so much, all their telephone lines are destroyed. One of the commanders at the bridge actually has to cycle to the rear areas to inform commanders about what's happened. So the Americans are already on the bridge by the time they give the order. And then when the plunger is pressed, the bridge isn't demolished. Part of the side of the bridge is blown up and a few holes are blown in the roadway. But the bridge is still standing and the Americans are able to basically charge across this bridge in quite dramatic fashion. It's only defended quite lightly by some machine guns and there's no tanks or any heavy weaponry defending the bridge. The Germans are just spread too thin. So the Americans are able to very quickly take advantage of the situation and they capture the bridge. They sort of charge across, cutting off demolition charges and dropping them into the water as they go.
Wow.
And capture the German officers at the other end of the bridge who are in this railway tunnel trying to organise the demolition. So the Americans have done what they never thought they would be able to do and they've captured an intact bridge over the Rhine.
That sounds like the plot of a Hollywood movie.
It was a Hollywood movie. Yeah, it was eventually a Hollywood movie and it really lends itself to that. Any forces the Americans can pull together start streaming across the bridge, building up a perimeter. They manage to infiltrate some tanks over there. They very gingerly work their way across the bridge, trying not to fall into the gaps and reinforce the perimeter on the other side. And the other thing the Americans do is rush in AA defences, anti-air defences, because they know the Germans are not going to take this line down. They're going to try and bring down the bridge by whatever means necessary. So they start literally lining up bumper-to-bumper anti-aircraft guns on the bank of the river, preparing for that.
Establishing the Remagen bridgehead. Vehicles in long line move up to the span named after General Ludendorff. Nazi plans called for demolition of this bridge between Remagen on the west bank and Erpel on the east. But on 7th March, 9th Armored Division patrols removed the charges before serious damage could be done, and we had a bridge intact over the Rhine. Tanks and infantry crossed to capture Erpel and surrounding high ground before pushing on inland. The bridge's railroad tracks have been planked over for vehicular traffic. Our AKAK opposes persistent enemy attempts to dive bomb the Ludendorff Bridge. Despite these attacks, the bridgehead rapidly expands. This marks the first breaching of the Rhine River line since Napoleon crossed in 1805.
the US forces stream across the bridge. Are they then dashing across into enemy territory, left, right and centre, and really taking charge of the situation? Or did they meet obstacles on the other side of the Rhine?
Obviously, as soon as the Germans do realise what's happened, they start trying to restrict that bridgehead. And obviously, there is only a limited amount of troops that the Americans can get across the river. When the Germans start bombarding the bridge with all the artillery they've got, it actually becomes a very dangerous situation around the approaches to the bridge and in the town of Remagen itself. And that leads to pretty high casualties of troops approaching to cross the bridge. And they are literally queuing up to cross the bridge while being shelled.
Wow.
And the approach to the bridge becomes known as Dead Man's Corner. In that situation, there's a limited amount of troops that can actually get across the bridge. And the Americans start trying to build pontoon bridges to one side to increase the flow of traffic. But it's obviously a slow process. While this is all going on, the Germans are using every weapon to try and take down the bridge. So they're firing on it with artillery. They're using these very heavy siege guns that are designed for use against fortresses. They're very immobile. They fire at the bridge for quite a few hours, but they fail to hit it. And as what happens with these weapons is that after they fire a certain number of shells, they have to go back for repair because the rifling in the barrel is so damaged that they have to be refitted. So they have to withdraw without doing any damage. The Germans are also sending an aircraft to bomb the bridge. They take very heavy casualties from all of these AA guns that have been set up and mostly get nowhere near the bridge. And Luftwaffe are getting really desperate and sending a very sort of antiquated aircraft like the old Stukas that were very effective at the start of the war, but in 1945 are just not up to the task. But they're also using their new jet aircraft to try and hit the bridge. What this is having the effect of with the air forces, but also the land forces of the Germans, is drawing them all in to focus on Remagen and enabling the Americans to inflict pretty heavy casualties on them.
CX-MSS-T484-7. Orders at 0115 hours on the 10th of March 1945 from Flieger Division 1-5. Destruction of the Remagen Bridge decisive for the defence of the Rhine. Task on 10th to be fulfilled if necessary by suicide attack. Immediate report required of crews volunteering, of whom 3 to be detailed for first takeoff. Load not to be less than 500 kilogram Trialan bomb. Crew, 1 man only. Method of attack? Dive along the length of the bridge at the lowest possible altitude. Fuse setting without delay action. Target point? Piers of the bridge. Immediate readiness from 0400 hours.
The other thing the Germans are using is their V weapons, so they're firing V2s at the bridge. 11 V2s fired at the bridge. And now the V2 is not an accurate enough weapon to be used tactically, but they are getting desperate. So the closest actually lands only 270 metres away from the bridge, and a few hit the sort of surrounding area and do cause casualties. The furthest actually hits Cologne 30 miles away. So it it would be blind luck if any of the V2s hit the bridge, but they try.
It sounds like a desperate attempt to throw everything they have at it.
Yeah. The other thing they try is using frogmen, like divers, and also some engineers on boats to literally swim up to the bottom of the bridge supports and lay explosives. And those people are either shot down in the water or captured as soon as they get to the bridge. But the most effective thing is the artillery, and it does start to damage the bridge and the area around it. So the bridge survives long enough that the Americans are able to build these two pontoon bridges and actually rely on them instead of the main railway bridge. They want to keep the bridge intact because it's heavy duty and it can take traffic like heavy tanks, like the T-26 tanks that the Americans have just started to deploy, which are too heavy to cross the pontoon bridges. But mostly they're relying on these pontoon bridges to cross the river at this stage. The engineers are working on the bridge, and that's when the Germans are finally able to bring it down, just through the persistent pounding it's taken from artillery. So on the 17th of March, the bridge does finally collapse. There are 200 engineers on the bridge when it collapses, but miraculously only 33 of them are killed. Quite a few are injured, but most of them do manage to survive, which is rather amazing. But by that point, because these two pontoon bridges are built, the bridgehead is basically secure.
On the Western Front, headquarters announced today that part of the Ludendorff Bridge has collapsed, carrying a number of American engineers into the swiftly flowing Rhine 70 feet below. According to the official information, enemy action was not directly responsible. By one of those odd coincidences, a few hours after the Ludendorff Bridge fell in, the Germans announced that 4 German officers had been put to death after a court-martial for neglect of duty, which permitted the American First Army to capture the bridge 10 days ago.
Eventually, the Americans established a bridgehead about 25 miles wide all the way up the east bank of the Rhine. And this is drawing in German counterattacks. They finally get themselves together to launch, I suppose, the heaviest possible counterattack around the 23rd and 24th of March. But by that point, the chance of recapturing the bridge is pretty minuscule. And the Germans, they aren't able to pull together enough tanks, and they aren't able to fuel enough tanks really to get them to the front line to take part in any serious counteroffensive. So they make very little progress. Yeah, so the Allies have got their bridge over the Rhine now. Job done. They don't need to launch an assault crossing. The thing is, the crossing at Remagen isn't the main axis of advance. All the Allied logistic arrangements have been set up to support the planned crossing further north, and that doesn't change because it would be too disruptive to do that. So the Remagen bridgehead is supported as a way to draw in German troops, but it's not the main axis of advance.
It sounds very much like the Germans are scrambling to get the various means of defence together at Remagen. Surely Bletchley Park must have been picking up on a lot of traffic associated with this.
Yeah, absolutely. They're not monitoring so much precise events as they're unfolding on the ground. When we think about how signals intelligence fits into the picture, I think we can argue that actually the Allies on the ground start to outgrow the need for SIGINT, at least in the same way that they'd needed it before. It's not really a decisive tool any longer, because the Allies basically are going to win anyway. They don't need to carry out any particularly complex stratagems. They don't need to deceive the enemy. That's not to say what Bletchley's doing isn't really helpful, because they're providing all this information about what the Allies are going to face. And that is making the job easier, and it's reducing Allied casualties at every stage. That's beyond doubt. But maybe it's not the decisive factor. Maybe it's just something that's making it easier that's not, you know, the main factor enabling the Allies to win. So, for example, General Bradley gets a full list of every German corps and divisional command post of all the German troops that are facing him. So he's got this fantastic information at his fingertips. But does that tip the balance of the campaign that he's waging? Not really, because his troops are going to go forward and probably defeat those Germans, whatever happens. What their role is really is to give the Allies a really good idea of what the Germans have at their disposal, especially as concerns these new jet aircraft and the V weapons and things like that. So this is a Bletchley contribution which isn't often recognised, the role in monitoring the production of jet aircraft. And they're able to work out quite accurately what aircraft the Germans are developing and what their capabilities are and how many of them they're producing. And this is all fed to the section of air intelligence, which is tasked with monitoring aircraft production.
Ultra material was of the utmost value to this section, and especially in providing almost all our information about the jet aircraft program. Except for this source, we should have known very little about it.
Harry Hinsley, The Official History of British Intelligence in the Second World War, Volume 3, Part 2.
They were monitoring the production of jets. They were also able, I suppose, to monitor the deployment of those jets and the location of where they were headed. So did Bletchley Park have a bigger picture of the aircraft capability of the Germans at that point?
They've got a very good picture. And the consequence of this, I suppose, is that when they do capture the bridge, the Allies have a very good idea of exactly what the Germans are going to be able to throw at them. And they can plan accordingly. And that's obviously very helpful. This goes for the V weapons as well. Another thing which happens in March, slightly away from the battlefronts, is that the V1 offensive against London is resumed because the Germans have been able to actually increase the range of the weapon, of these sort of flying bombs. And again, this is something that Bletchley Park had been monitoring. A really useful source is actually Japanese diplomatic communications, just like we'd seen with D-Day a bit earlier in the war. Every time the Germans have a new weapon, they show it off to the Japanese, and then they dutifully report it back to Tokyo, and Bletchley Park reads it.
I thought you were going to say communications between the German Air Force or civilian communications about production or something like that, but it's actually coming from their allies.
Yeah, the Japanese material is really important throughout. So in late 1944, they get wind of this plan to increase the range of the V1, and they were able to sort of plot out its possible effects. That means that when they start firing them again in March 1945, the defences are all ready. So they fire about 250 V1s. Only about 125 actually reach England, only 13 actually reach London and hit London. They're actually able to shoot down or intercept the vast majority of them by this stage, using a combination of aircraft and anti-air guns.
Is that terrible hit rate caused by the intelligence that was put together through Ultra? Was that a direct result of Ultra intelligence that led to that?
It's pretty direct, because it's only by knowing the capabilities of the weapon as well as they do that they can come up with those countermeasures. With V2s, there aren't such direct countermeasures to it, but at least knowing what the Germans are doing, how many they have in the field, and where they're based is all very helpful. The anti-V2 campaign is mostly about hitting the launching sites, and that has a mixed effect. There's one occasion where the Germans are firing V2s from a forest in The Hague in Holland, and the Allies try to bomb the launching sites, but they miss and hit the adjacent residential neighbourhood and kill several hundred civilians, burn quite a few houses to the ground, and completely miss the V2s. So they're not able to counter that threat as effectively as they are with the V1s. But they are at least able to monitor what the Germans are doing all the way up to when they finally end the V-weapon campaign. The last references in SIGINT to V-weapons came in the middle of April.
Because they were in retreat, these V2s had to be sent up from a lorry with a trailer. And the lorry and the trailer would move away from their supply base, hide in a wood or by the coast, or even in car parks. Now, it took them 25 minutes from the moment of launch before those lorries could move on. What we had to do, once we got the fall of shot, which naturally was after they'd landed, we would then marry it with the one point of the trajectory that was picked up by the mobile radars that were on the continent by then. Using a slide rule, we would extrapolate the curve backwards to the launch site. So we had 4 minutes they landed, 6 minutes for us. We'd move it on to intelligence, which might take another 2 minutes. They would check up with the sound from the Royal Army Service Corps, I think it was, and they would send sound positions in, and those two bits of information would then give, with our information, the launching. And we had mosquitoes in the air permanently in the areas where they might be operating, and the nearest section of mosquitoes would bomb the lorries. And by the end of February, beginning of March 1945, all those lorries were annihilated, and the Germans' manufacturing never managed to catch up with it. And by that time, they were launching them from Hanover District, Rotterdam and farther north, that sort of area. We went on right to VE Day, plotting them.
You've been talking mostly about the Americans and their crossing the Remagen Bridge. You've also mentioned that the main advance was further north than this. And we've obviously got the British and the Canadians in the picture as well. Can you just give us a summary of where people are at this point?
Yeah, sure. So if we can sort of picture, basically, the Rhine River runs south to north. And in the north, we've got the British and Canadians who have come out of Holland and moved south parallel to the river. That's Operation Veritable. A bit further south, we've got the US 9th Army, which is under Montgomery's command, as well as the British and Canadians. And they've moved to the Rhine, directly west in Operation Grenade. Going a bit further south, we've got the US 1st Army, and they've made the crossing at Remagen. And where Veritable and Grenade have taken place, that's north of Cologne. And sort of south of Cologne is where the Remagen Bridge is. And if we go even further south than that, all the way down to Frankfurt sort of area of Germany, you've got Patton's 3rd Army, which has fought all the way from Normandy through France, through sort of Alsace, the Saarland, and is now itself on another part of the Rhine and thinking about carrying out its own crossing. So you've got several areas where the sort of the defence of Germany is being pierced at this stage. But the main effort is in the north. This has been decided by Eisenhower and the Allied commanders. And that's where preparations are being made for the main crossing.
Can you tell us about that then?
So the operation is called Operation Plunder. Some historians have argued it's a bit overkill at this stage. The force of the Allies are amassing is pretty overwhelming. They've got something like 4,000 guns and about three armies all lined up ready to assault. Whether this is entirely necessary, given the state the German army is in, is open to question. And that's sort of made even more pertinent by the fact that German forces are being drawn into Remagen. But nonetheless, Montgomery makes his preparations thoroughly. He makes them very well. He wants to have all his ducks in a row before he launches an operation. It served him well in the past. After Veritable, which turned into a bit of a grueling slog, he wants to make sure that things are going to go smoothly, and he doesn't want to get too many of his men killed this close to the end of the war.
So the Germans were thoroughly outnumbered and thoroughly outgunned at this point?
Absolutely. So the attack's due to be launched on the 23rd of March. Actually, the night before is when Patton makes his crossing. Third Army achieves a small penetration across the Rhine in its area, literally just so Patton can say that he got across the Rhine before Montgomery. Because the two men are not the biggest fans of each other. But the main action is in the north. It starts off with an extended barrage by these 4,000 guns, which basically eliminates German resistance along most of the bank of the river. And that's followed up by a night crossing on the 23rd. by some of the commando units. And they cross without being detected and wait until the morning. They occupy the town of Vesel, or city of Vesel, I should say. And that all goes fairly smoothly. And that's followed up by the assault crossings of the rest of the divisions. You've got British divisions and American divisions crossing in slightly different places. Mostly they meet pretty dazed German defenders who aren't really willing to put up too much of a fight. So it all goes relatively smoothly. The river crossings are started early in the morning, a little bit later in the morning, about 9 a.m. There's an airborne drop. It's the last big airborne operation of the war, called Operation Varsity. And it drops two divisions behind the river line. The original plan was for 3 divisions to drop, which would really have been a show of strength. But the Allies actually have the problem they don't have enough transport aircraft to carry all those men. So in the end, it's 2 divisions, 6th British Airborne, which was the one who dropped into Normandy, and the new American Airborne Division, 17th Airborne. And the idea is that they capture key towns, woods, villages, bridges as well, behind the river line, so that if the Germans do make any attempt to hem the bridgehead in, the airborne forces will have captured the routes out.
In the paratroop planes, the men are waiting for the jump. In the tow planes, the pilots pull at the release catches, and the gliders slide free. They are on the ground. They are beyond the Rhine. With one terrific blow, they have begun the last great battle in the West. Now they will unload, deploy, and drive forward for their objectives. The crossroads, the bridges, the strong points, which might hinder the land armies, thrusting along behind them. Meanwhile, on the west bank of the Great River, amphibious tanks of the British Second Army are crossing in a never-ending stream. A whole night of concentrated fire has wiped out the gun positions that might have stopped them. And while they are crossing to establish a bridgehead, other tanks, half-tracks, and heavy guns will be ferried over or cross on the pontoons that engineers are busily building. These are troops of General Simpson's 9th Army. This is part of the tremendous force that is breaking the German line in the west. Starting at 21 hours on the 23rd of March and continuing all through the night and following day, the reinforcements pour across. The enemy's river line is gone. His secondary positions are overrun. Into the broad Westphalian plain that stretches 260 miles to Berlin, the tanks and troops start driving forward. They have a rendezvous to keep with the Red Army, and they intend to be on time.
Obviously, the crossing of the Rhine is quite a big moment. So Churchill wants to actually be there, and he comes across to Europe to witness the event and basically makes a nuisance of himself. At one point, he relieves himself on a bit of the Siegfried line, but he asks the journalists not to report that fact. But he wants to be there at this key sort of decisive moment of finally crossing the Rhine and crossing that big marker of the fact that you're there finally in Germany.
Already the first prisoners from the east bank are waiting to be ferried across. Beaten, disorganized, and dejected, they had seen the beginning of the end. And whom do they encounter in midstream but the irrepressible Prime Minister, who has come to see for himself. With Field Marshal Montgomery and American generals of the 21st Army Group, Mr. Churchill crosses the Rhine and comes ashore. Pulling on his cigar in obvious satisfaction, he chats with a group of British Tommies. And though his aides try in vain to dissuade him, he insists on touring the ground from which German troops had been driven only a few hours before. Later, he takes a look at German positions still under fire. With General Eisenhower, he watches the artisans of victory, who from east and west are driving the giant blows, speeding the hour the whole world has awaited for over 5 bitter years.
In addition to these 2 airborne divisions, how many men are we talking about here on the Allied side?
So the figure I've got for troops on the Allied side is 1,284,000 men.
That's an enormous
Which is an enormous concentration of force.
And they're all making this crossing?
Well, no, most of them aren't making this crossing. This is the thing, this is where it gets slightly tricky trying to count how many people are involved in a battle. The logistic tail of the Allied armies at this stage is enormous. It's certainly more than half of the entire force are just, you know, people driving trucks, cooking all the food, supply units, people running repair workshops.
Support services.
Yeah, all of these support jobs that have to happen to keep the old fighting man in the field. And then if you look at the fighting units, most of them aren't in the front line. The standard thing for each level of the sort of hierarchy of units is to put about half or a third of your force up to fight the enemy and keep 2/3 or a half of it back in reserve. So a division will have one brigade up and two down, and then a brigade will have maybe two battalions up and two down, and then each battalion will have a certain number of companies up and a certain number down. So actually, even if you look at these enormous military forces, the number of men actually in contact with the enemy at any particular point is actually a very small number. So we're talking about a crossing that carried out by a few thousand men, really, who are at the sharp end.
But all this 1.2 million or something like that, they still have to be accounted for, they still have to defend themselves, they still have to be supported in the field.
Yeah, and this is why they can't move the operation to Remagen as well. Once you set these plans in motion, you start building up the logistics. You've got to think about just how you move these men and their supplies around. There's a point during Operation Veritable when a division is sent forward and it doesn't really have space to operate. And the result is that two divisions are trying to operate on the same lines and it ends up with a 10-mile traffic jam of trucks bumper to bumper all the way back into the rear areas because they just don't have space for their military units to fit on the ground. And exactly the same problem is involved with plunder, of course. So about 16,000 paratroopers drop. The weather's good. The drops are mostly unopposed. The advantage is that because the river crossing troops have gone in a few hours earlier, most of the German troops who were defending the landing zones have moved. So the Germans are quite aware that an airborne drop is possible, but they don't have enough troops to defend the river and all the landing zones. So the landing zones are pretty much free by the time the paratroopers go in. They're mostly on target. There are some American paratroopers which land in a British drop zone, but this is all to be expected as part of an airborne operation. It's just a limitation of that sort of battle. And they capture all their objectives according to plan. Casualties are fairly high, about 3,000 men become casualties. But again, this is a standard cost of launching an airborne operation. It's dangerous work, basically. But it all goes relatively smoothly and casualties are actually slightly underestimates. The Allies spend a few days building up their bridgehead. And from about 28th of March, Allied troops are breaking out of the bridgehead they've established in Plunder. And they start pushing out into Germany. And German resistance is sort of rapidly collapsing. The British move into northern Germany. The Canadians are beginning to clear out northern Holland. The US 9th Army goes back to American command. And along with the 1st Army, they start to encircle the Ruhr, which is Germany's industrial heartland. The whole operation, the whole Rhine crossing in Operation Plunder and Varsity, leads to about 7,000 Allied casualties. And if you think about how Veritable had produced about 23,000 casualties, you get an impression of how much easier it is getting for the Allies now. The Germans really aren't putting up serious resistance, even though they've had this fantastic natural defensive barrier to defend. They haven't been able to seriously hinder the Allies.
And now for our first report from overseas to Supreme Headquarters, Charles Collingwood reporting.
The bridgeheads of the American 9th Army and the British 2nd Army have linked up and mushroomed out until they form a single bridgehead 30 miles long and up to 7 miles deep, almost as big as the Remagen bridgehead. During yesterday, they took 8,000 prisoners. The resistance is getting stiffer, but so far there is no sign that the Germans have been able to get their reserves to the scene, and no large-scale counterattacks have been made. The bridgehead is steadily being expanded, but it's emphasized here at Schaeff that the next few days will be spent building up our forces east of the Rhine, and that the spectacular advances won't come until after the buildup is finished. While British and American troops were crossing the Rhine north of the Ruhr, the last German resistance west of the Rhine collapsed under the pressure of the 3rd and 7th Armies. The Germans suddenly began to pull out yesterday, crossing the Rhine on homemade rafts and anything they could lay their hands on, and by day's end there was only a small pocket left west of Karlsruhe. The 3rd Army's bridgehead south of Mainz is growing swiftly. Yesterday they took 9 towns and got to within 3 miles of Darmstadt. They counted a record number of prisoners, 18,818. The 1st Army's Remagen bridgehead spread out up to 3 miles in the south, but in the north, they sustained their first major counterattack, which was launched at 6:20 this morning and has been going on all day. In spite of the counterattack, the 1st Army took 1,600 prisoners yesterday. Two things which stand out from today's fighting are the slowness with which the Germans are reacting. The only place they have counterattacked is in the two-week-old Remagen bridgehead, and the speed with which they are surrendering. We counted 20,000 prisoners yesterday. The Germans are acting like a tired, confused army which knows it is beaten.
The Germans are on the back foot now. Their forces are in decline. Is the picture at Bletchley Park an echo of this in terms of intelligence?
Yes and no. We talked a bit before in the Ardennes episode about Bletchley's intelligence problems, and those are still sort of true. there are limitations in what you can derive from signals intelligence. It's up to the commander in the field to interpret it in the way that he sees fit, and that does cause problems from time to time. And Bletchley isn't really giving the commanders big giveaways about what's going to happen anymore at this stage of the war. It's not about big giveaways. It's not about one piece of evidence tells you the entire German plan. It's more about building up small pieces of information and getting a really good picture of what's going on behind the German lines. And that all works pretty smoothly, and it's a very useful tool for the Allied commanders. So that's great as far as intelligence is concerned. The problems Bletchley Park is having at this stage is actually in cryptography. And we might make the assumption that they've been reading these German codes for 5 years now, and they've probably got a pretty good grasp on them, and it's all routine to break them.
It's a habit to just do it now. Yeah. Same old, same old.
But that's not true at all. Actually, this is one of Bletchley's hardest periods for actual code breaking, because the Germans are bringing in improvements in procedure and in security, which really should have been in place from the start of the war. If they had been in place at the start of the war, maybe Bletchley would never have existed. Maybe we wouldn't be here talking about it, because the German codes ought to have been unbreakable. In fact, the Germans give the Allies a way in. It means they're never able to quite lock them out again, but they come close.
So we're not talking about improvements to, say, the machines they're using. We're talking about the techniques they're using to operate them and to manage that process.
Yeah, it's mostly down to operating procedure and, yeah, things like that. What Gordon Welshman argues, Gordon Welshman is the head of Hut 6, and he puts together a lot of these procedures which Bletchley uses to, you know, great effect, all the systems that they need to efficiently break the German codes, especially Enigma. Welshman argues that if the Germans had brought in their security measures at the start of the war, Bletchley would have never got off the ground. Because not only does it give the codebreakers a way into the Enigma, but also the fact that they've achieved some success allows them to recruit more people, gain the resources they need to expand the effort. That means the right people are in the right places at the right time, that when the Germans do make improvements, they can overcome those problems rather than being locked out, you know, and failing. So Welshman argues that the whole learning and development process at the Government Code and Cipher School pays off later in the war, once large amounts of intelligence are being decrypted and once it becomes actionable on the ground as well. So there might be an alternate history we can suggest where GCNCS fails to break Enigma, and as the Germans bring in new security measures, the British just fall further and further behind, and their chance of breaking in just becomes less and less. But thankfully, they were able to get their foot in the door and keep the door open throughout the war.
I do not know whether the Germans abandoned the double encipherment procedure because they had discovered its vulnerability. However, this early error was extremely important to us, for without it, the Hut 6 balloon might never have gotten off the ground. We would have been in bad shape. First, and I cannot stress this too strongly, if in the early days of the war we had not been developing apparatus that would undoubtedly enable us to break Enigma keys, we would not have been able to obtain permission to build up Hut 6 quickly as an exploiting organisation. We would probably not have been able to recruit the key people who made such important contributions later on. Herivel, in particular, might not have joined us, and it is by no means certain that anyone but he would have discovered the Herivel tip, without which we could not have used sillies to break Enigma keys by manual methods.
Gordon Welshman, The Hut 6 Story.
So the sort of deadlock situation where Bletchley can't break into the German codes and the Germans are just making them better and better, that's what's threatening to actually happen at the end of the war, at least with Enigma. The pendulum is sort of swinging back in favour of the Germans.
Why is it so late on in the war that the Germans make these improvements?
Well, first of all, I have to say there's no evidence the Germans know that the Brits are reading their codes. They're probably aware that the Allies have captured a certain amount of cipher materials.
They must be aware that there's effort involved in trying to.
Obviously, they know the Allies are trying to break their codes. They have people in Germany doing the same thing with Allied codes. So they know cryptography is a thing. They know the Allies have captured German codes. They know they can read a certain amount of traffic because they can use those key sheets to read the intercepted messages. But other than those occasions, there's no evidence that they knew their ciphers were being broken on a regular basis. Possibly they were worried that increasing amounts of cipher material are falling into Allied hands and that might give them a way in, so they have to safeguard themselves against that. But also I think we have to understand that German military doesn't have one concerted policy. There's numerous agencies that are all working at odds against each other. There are people responsible for ensuring cipher security who are measuring their success based on how many improvements they can enact. And they are not the same people who are actually evaluating the security of German codes and who've decided there's nothing to worry about and that they're still perfectly secure. They're different groups of people. They're all working across purposes. Arguably, if you had a more centralised and sort of sensible organisation, You wouldn't be putting resources into improving your cipher materials when, you know, you're about to lose the war anyway because your army is collapsing and your air force has ceased to exist. Obviously, these measures are too little too late to win the war, but the German military isn't working rationally. So that's my reading of the situation. It's something that really deserves more research. I don't believe anyone has done a comprehensive study of German cybersecurity across the board. It's something that needs more work on, but I think that's a fair way of looking at it.
The Germans are improving their procedures throughout the war and even at this late stage. Were the British doing exactly the same thing, improving their procedures, or were they confident that their codes weren't being broken?
Well, the British had the great advantage that they're reading the German codes, so if there were any snippets of info about the Germans breaking their codes, they would tend to know about it. That has happened before. The British have made improvements. The naval codes especially were an area that were relatively weak for a time. But what the British do much better than the Germans is this sort of poacher-turned-gamekeeper style of running things, where you have your cryptographers or your cryptanalysts looking for weaknesses in enemy systems and then thinking, how can we feed that knowledge back into improving our own systems? And so the Government Code and Cipher School is breaking German codes, but it's also the department responsible for producing Allied codes.
Which I don't think a lot of people necessarily know, that the two are so closely combined and so closely linked.
Yeah, there's a whole section based at Mansfield College, Oxford, called the Construction Section, which puts all these codes together, all these one-time pads and all these books of cipher materials. And that's obviously a big sort of bureaucratic job as much as an intellectual one. But there's also cryptanalysts working at Bletchley. John Tiltman is one, for example, who invents some of the British codes. One of the ones he invents is a sort of stencil cipher, which is then used in the Navy. And actually, it's mirrored on the German side because the Germans bring in their own stencil cipher about the same time.
What do you mean a stencil? Can you explain what a stencil is?
So the idea is you have a sort of frame with a certain pattern on a stencil, and you get a key sheet, which is like a grid of letters or numbers, and you put the key sheet in the stencil and you read off according to what numbers you can actually see. That becomes your cipher key. And that produces a sort of quasi randomness to the cipher, which makes it quite hard to break. And this is something that John Tiltman realises and something the Germans realise about the same time. The problem with Tiltman's cipher is that it's quite fiddly to use and the operators don't like it very much. They get lazy. And when the Germans bring in their system, that's exactly the problem they have as well. The operators are lazy. The German system is called a Rasterschlüssel, just means stencil key. And this is used on a lot of the medium grade army and air material, so a step below Enigma. And it's stuff that Bletchley's actually been trying to read for most of the war, with sort of limited success. Up to that point, the Germans have been using something called double playfair. A playfair cipher is a cipher where you get a keyword and you take the letters of the keyword and write them out in a grid. And then you add in all the other letters of the alphabet that aren't in the keyword. And then you substitute the letters of your message based on the positions of the letters in the grid, basically. And that's a relatively old-fashioned method of doing it, and not a very secure one, but the Germans do double playfair, so they encipher it twice. And that makes it a lot tougher to read. And Bletchley has read that material from time to time, but often too late for it to be valuable. So the value of that material is questionable. When the Germans bring in the Rasterschlüssel, again, that makes things even harder. And Bletchley basically gives up on reading army and air medium-grade material. It's just not worth the resources it takes, because the information you're getting just isn't valuable enough. It isn't current enough. The only thing Bletchley is trying to read is when the Rasterschlüssel is used on the German police networks, because they're interested in what's happening in Germany. And that's the sort of material where you could read it maybe when it's a few weeks out of date and it will still be valuable. So they're still trying to read German police material, but not so much army air stuff. When they do manage to read it, though, it's almost invariably because the Germans have got lazy and they've used the same key for several days because the operator doesn't want to mess around with working out how his stencil works. So it's interesting how those issues with the systems mirror on both sides. And it shows how when you're designing a crypto system, you need to account for the human aspect and you need to make it simple enough that the operator can easily use the systems. If you make it too complicated, it might make it very, very secure in perfect circumstances. But if the operator gets lazy or he makes mistakes, then it makes it a lot weaker, you know, in reality. That's one system where Bletchley is basically locked out of something that they could read earlier in the war. The other crises are around Enigma. So if we look at Hut 6, who handle the army air Enigma, Hut 6 go through two crises towards the end of the war. The first is in November 1944, the second is in February 1945. And that's because the Germans start to actually encipher their call signs. The problem is one of registration. So when material comes into the hut straight from the Y stations, the first job is to work out how it's been enciphered. And that means you need to know which network it was sent on and therefore which Enigma key it's been enciphered in. And until you can do that, you can't do anything else, because if you don't know how the message is enciphered, you can't possibly break it. And at the start of the war, the Germans would use something called a discriminant, which would tell the people on their network what key they'd use to encipher the message. So that was easy. Bletchley could just read the discriminants. In 1943, the Germans stopped using discriminants, and Bletchley have to start getting a deeper understanding of their call sign systems and sort of frequencies they're using to monitor the German networks. And that leads them to undertake some reorganization. And then in November 1944, what the Germans enact is basically an unbreakable system of encoding their call signs. So Bletchley can no longer work out who he's talking to who from the call signs. And the other thing they do is they start changing the frequencies of their networks every third day. So every 3 days, all the frequencies will change around. And again, you can't link a particular frequency to a particular network. And all of a sudden, Bletchley has very little way of knowing when the material comes into the hut, who sent it, and how it's enciphered. And that's a real problem. The data is saved, really, by the Y operators. So when Army keys go onto the new system, the analysts at Bow Manor, which is the main Army Y station, are able to maintain coverage of the German networks because they have such an intimate understanding of the habits of the German operators, you know, their particular way of signalling in Morse, called their fist. There's a certain amount you can learn from direction finding to find out where stations are and plot them on the map. And all of this allows them, through very, very careful analysis, continuous analysis as well, because if you drop your coverage for a day or two, you will lose track of the networks. But if you can maintain your coverage, you can track what the German networks are doing and then feed that information into Hut 6. So Hut 6 can be informed of what key the German networks go on to. And then they have this big problem of how you organize all that material. And it really leads them to go from a system where that's very straightforward and you can have a few people working on what they call research and doing very specialist work to find out when you get the odd message that you can't place, to find out where that fits into the system. They go to a system which is much more haphazard, where they do miss a lot of material, where a lot of it is misfiled, but they view it better to misfile something than not file it at all. And that's the only way they have really to deal with the ever greater volume of material they have now that they've got less ability to actually identify it. So when the air keys go onto the new system in February 1944, that's the biggest crisis for Hut 6. Most of their material comes from the air keys. It always has done. So that's just a much larger mass of material that they suddenly have to deal with and try and make sense of. So Stuart Milner Barry, who's in charge of Hut 6 at that point, called it the longest and hardest of any of our crises. So their output of air decrypts dropped from about 1,800 a day to 1,000 a day. So it's a big drop off. But they are eventually able to recover the situation and air decrypts start rising again towards the end of the war. But in the meantime, actually, what happens is that army material becomes more numerous than air material for the first time in the war. And a lot of the army material actually becomes what they call more operational. As the German military is collapsing, the effect on the air keys is to spread it out between lots of different keys, and that makes it harder to track. The effect on the army traffic is actually the opposite. It becomes concentrated on a few major keys, and that means once they can break those easily, then that's most of the traffic on the airwaves. So the army material actually shoots up in this period. And the army cryptographers who'd always been in the situation of doing long-term research work and never really having juicy operational material coming out of their decrypts. All of a sudden, they are the stars of the show and they get their moment of triumph, really, where a lot of the material they're generating is actually very valuable.
With the improvements in the German security and procedural changes that they made, this obviously had quite a lot of effect on Bletchley Park's successes. The Allies were taking territory all the time. Were they not capturing material from the Germans, instruction books and so on, that helped find a way into some of these challenges?
The Allies are doing that. And the thing is, they do know about these changes before they happen because the Germans talk about it. A lot of these new procedures are announced on the networks that they can currently read before they change over.
So they saw it coming?
Yeah, they can see a lot of these coming. Most of them, they predict them and they can make preparations. So if you have something like the situation Hut 6 was in, you can make preparations for that.
24th of January 1945, top secret ultra for signals unit senior SLU officer, decipher for yourself and pass to all recipients. 1. We have hard evidence of the introduction of encoded call signs by the German Air Force, which is a much more prolific source to us than the Army, on February the 1st. The ingenious device of combining encoded call signs with frequent changes of frequencies will indeed be a most impressive stride by the Germans towards almost complete wireless security. 2. Often we have surmounted past difficulties better than expected, but this latest is likely to prove that his predecessors were picnics by comparison. 3. In the first few weeks we are bound to suffer a serious loss in currency and volume. the latter perhaps as heavy as 40 to 50%. But we have revolutionary changes underway, and we expect gradually to climb back. Not to where we were before, but nevertheless to a point from which we can still be quite useful to you. 4. Anxious not to spread undue alarm and despondency, but feel it right to give you warning in what we see as fair perspective. Signed, Eric Jones.
Through all these problems, Hut 6 worked through them. They are looking by the end of the war as if they could keep going, but as German forces collapse a little bit before the end of the war, in sort of mid-April, a lot of the traffic tails off because there just aren't the forces that need to talk to each other anymore. And that's a bit of an anticlimax for some of the cryptographers in Hut 6. But they can be happy at the end of the day that they came through all these successive crises and overcame them and were still in the fight at the end of the war.
Hut 6, the army, the air force side of things, they're having all these troubles. Hut 8, a naval though, is still getting quite a lot of success. The U-boat war is continuing and they're still succeeding in reading all that traffic, aren't they?
Well, actually, no. By the end of the war, Hut 8 can't read U-boat traffic anymore.
Hut 8 can't read U-boat traffic. So Bletchley has no traffic at all coming from U-boats. I'm very surprised by this.
They have a certain amount of intelligence about U-boats. I mean, it's well known that they break the Shark Key, which the U-boats are using at the end of 1942, break it for good in 1943, and they read Shark to the end of the war. That's absolutely correct. They're reading Shark. That's fine. And they've actually outsourced the task to the Americans in Washington. But the U-boats aren't using Shark anymore. The U-boats are using what they call Sonderschlüssel, special keys. A Sonderschlüssel is an Enigma key. So it's a way of setting up the machine. The machine is the standard four-rotor M4 Enigma. And every single U-boat has its own keys. And the other thing they're doing is, because they're operating a lot closer to their home ports, they're getting orders before they leave port, and they're never carrying them on the airwaves anyway. But the key problem is Hut 8 can't read Sonderschlüssel. And the problem is the Sonderschlüssel don't carry enough traffic to be breakable. You need a certain amount of depth, as is a technical term, and you need to be able to take a guess at what's in the message for your bomb machine to break it. You need a crib. And there is just not enough traffic on the airwaves to read these keys. Hut 8 do manage to read 3 Sonderschlüssel, but that's out of about 50 different keys being used by U-boats, and they're changed about every 3 weeks. So there's an awful amount of U-boat traffic out there which they just can't read anymore. They're still finding out about U-boats because they're reading Shark, because they're reading the traffic that's travelling between the U-boat bases and the U-boat high command. One of the very handy things that Admiral Dönitz does is issue these grand orders of the day, which come out quite regularly, and they often provide a really nice long message, which is easily guessable, that gives Hut 8 a way in.
Does this inability to read what the U-boats themselves are generating translate to a drop in success in the U-boat war?
It does, because Bletchley before had been able to basically pin U-boats onto the map to work out exactly where they were. They can't do that anymore. There's other things which feed into this. A lot of the U-boats are equipped with something called the Schnorkel, which is a device which allows them to run their diesel engines underwater. So they can stay submerged for days at a time, all the way from their bases to their sort of operational areas. And that meant you can't track them from the air either. So the Admiralty is having a lot of trouble tracking U-boats at this point. It does lead to the tonnage sunk by U-boats going up. In the first quarter of 1945, a higher tonnage is sunk than in any quarter of 1944. So things aren't quite as bad as they were back in the dark days of 1942, 1943, but they're getting worse. Thankfully, this is where Allied predominance of strength comes in very handy. Because, as I said before, SIGINT isn't required to have a decisive impact, because even though they're not tracking the U-boats very effectively, the Allies literally have so many radar-equipped planes and corvettes and destroyers sailing around hunting down U-boats that they can be very proactive when they appear and sink them very, very effectively. And that does serve to offset the fact that they've got less intelligence at their disposal. Bletchley's reading all those other keys. That's made a bit harder by the fact that they start adopting the four-rotor Enigma. There's barely any naval networks which now use a three-rotor Enigma, the old one. But that's not a big problem because there's plenty of four-rotor bombs that are now available for Bletchley to use. A further problem is caused on 1st of April when a new way of deciding on the Grundstellung part of the key is brought into effect. And this actually forces Hut 8 to start using a brand new machine. It's called the Filibuster. I haven't seen a picture of it, but it's been described as a modified bomb. And it's designed to reconstruct biogram tables, which are a slightly different part of the system. But it's adapted by Squadron Leader Jones, who's in charge of the bomb section, to tackle this new problem with the Grundstellung, which Naval Section has. So they're making these innovations, inventing new devices and thinking out how new ways to, you know, use their old devices. all the way up to the end of the war. And the fact that they're still reading plenty of naval networks, even though they can't read the U-boat ciphers anymore, leads to a peak of 19,902 decrypts in the week ending 17th of March. So that's the highest they've achieved in the whole war. But Hut 8, it does seem to have been the section that was having most difficulties with the new German procedures. Patrick Mahone, who's the head of Hut 8 at this stage, said in the history of Hut 8, "It was certainly more by luck than good management that we broke Dolphin, Place and Shark right up to the surrender." And here's a slightly odd fact that I discovered, which is that there is a new naval enigma key in early 1945 called Rorqual that actually didn't concern naval operations at all. It concerned the effects of Allied bombing in the Ruhr. And Naval Section broke it for Hut 3 and sent the information through to them. So that's a slightly bizarre application of naval keys, and I'm not sure what was going on to make them use the naval key to report on the effect of Allied bombing, but there you go.
If you had to summarise the picture of what things were like at Bletchley Park at this point in terms of success, what would you say?
I'd say they're still being very successful.
Despite all of these setbacks?
Yeah, so those Enigma huts are having problems, but they are working through those problems and they're basically coming out of the other end and they're still producing a lot of intelligence. There are other sections, if we look at the Testry and the Numeri, who are working on the Lorenz cipher, they're really going from strength to strength. So in early 1944, they were producing about 220 decrypts a month. By early 1945, it's up to 1,000. So their output is just going up and up and up, and they're not really having any serious setbacks. All of the Japanese material as well, we've seen how that feeds into operations on the Western Front, and you know, to my knowledge, there are no serious problems there either. So let's not focus too much on Enigma and think that's the whole story. Generally, across the board, Bletchley is doing very well. They're producing more intelligence and more decrypts for the commanders in the field than they have at any other point in the war.
And this is actionable intelligence. It's all useful stuff going to the front line to help contribute to the Allied successes.
Yeah, it's all building up a really complex picture, a really thorough picture of exactly what's going on within the borders of Germany, throughout the German armed forces, the German government as well. And that's all really valuable for the ground forces as they cross the Rhine and at long last begin to push into Germany.
This chase after the Germans flying in confusion from the banks of the Rhine has been one of the strangest experiences of the war. Our tanks have long ago left the torn and shattered landscape around Wesel and Xanten, where we first forced the crossing. They are now out in undamaged country, racing through villages which have never seen war. Villages from which the inhabitants haven't been forced to fly to the woods, as they were in the little places we captured nearer the bank. And for the first time, I think we are getting the real feeling of conquest. When you can drive, as I have today, for 30 miles along undamaged roads, with not a sign of the enemy and no sound of gunfire, and not the slightest trace of snipers or guerrilla fighting, or any last-minute defense, then the end can't be far off. Occasionally, little groups have tried to hold us up. The airborne boys told us of one such group, composed of Hitler youth, of about 15, who formed the bazooka team at a roadblock. But they were quickly swept aside, and our tanks and guns are rolling ahead through this level, well-tilled country, past the big red-brick farmhouses, everyone with this little white sheet hanging from the windows, and on through the woodlands, pressing eastward mile after mile without pause. And everyone is moving faster, because out here, we can see the end to it all now. And it's the strangest possible sensation to be driving almost at will, utterly unmolested, through the heart of your enemy's country. It just doesn't seem possible, and yet, somehow, here we are.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.